WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Claudia Brenner, is a victim of anti-gay violence. It's a terrifying story. Back in the summer of 1988, she was hiking with her lover, Rebecca White, on the Appalachian Trail. They thought they were alone, but a man who they'd run into at their campsite had followed them. He spied on them as they made love, then shot them, wounding Claudia and killing Rebecca. Claudia Brenner tells the story in her new book, Eight Bullets. She's an architect who also does a lot of public speaking about anti-gay violence. The man who shot her and killed her lover, Stephen Roy Carr, is now serving a life sentence in a Pennsylvania maximum security prison. I asked Claudia Brenner about her first encounter with Carr at the campsite.
Actually, the first encounter with the man who shot us was between he and Rebecca. Rebecca went up to use an outhouse on a campsite and also check a logbook, and she encountered this individual who she didn't expect to see, and he asked her for cigarettes. They had a brief exchange, and then she came back to me. I actually didn't see him or speak with him at that first encounter. But she told me that someone else was at the campsite with us. Up till that point, we had believed that we were completely alone. And so that was the first encounter.
And that was particularly awkward, too, because believing that you were alone, she was naked.
Right. We were only partially dressed, so that was extremely uncomfortable for her. And she believed it was also uncomfortable for the individual that she met. So we, of course, immediately put our clothes on and then had nothing really more to say or do with him.
And what was the second encounter?
I actually saw Stephen Roy Carr as we left the campsite. We packed up all our things a while later and left the campsite, and I actually saw him in a lean-to, and I believe, you know, I waved, said, see ya, when we passed by. So you might call that an encounter, but that was the first time I actually saw him. But a little later on, probably about an hour later, when we were hiking on the trail, we were checking our directions and looking at a map, and about 30 yards from us, I heard a voice saying, "Are you lost?" And of course, we weren't lost, and it was Stephen Roy Carr again. We went in one direction, and he continued on the trail in another direction, and I never really expected to see him again.
But he was carrying a gun, a rifle, wasn't he?
Yeah, that time when we met him on the trail, when we saw him on the trail, he had a rifle slung over his shoulders, and he had both of his arms draped over the ends of the rifle. And one of the things that struck me about that, or as I think about it in you know, the years since the shooting, is that he was extremely comfortable with that weapon. I think I make reference to how I've seen soldiers in countries which have soldiers on the streets a lot. I'm thinking about my experiences in Israel, how they have men carry weapons almost as an extension of their body, very, very, very comfortably. So when he was holding the rifle, it concerned me, but he was not threatening me with the rifle in any sense of the word, and so I believed that he was just continuing on his way and maybe going to shoot at some small game or something.
Right before you had shot, you had decided to make camp for the night. You were on the Appalachian Trail. You set up camp, and I believe you were making love, and then there was an explosion, or what felt like an explosion. What are your memories of what happened?
My memory was that the setting was really idyllic, and that I was completely enjoying myself in the warm early spring with a woman who I loved a lot, beside a stream with gurgling water and a blue sky, and that all of a sudden it felt like the world exploded. And I had no idea what had happened. I really thought about a volcano or an earthquake, but I saw blood everywhere. And I knew somehow that they wouldn't make you bleed, a volcano or an earthquake wouldn't make you bleed. And Rebecca somehow put together that there had been a gunshot. And, of course, my arm had been hit, and I was aware that, you know, it felt like my arm had exploded. And as soon as she said to me, "Where did you get shot?" I understood exactly what had happened.
There were eight bullets.
Yes.
That Stephen Roy Carr fired. What was the fate of each of those bullets?
The first bullet hit me in my arm as I described, and blood went everywhere. Very, very quickly, there were two more bullets. They hit me on both sides of my neck, kind of grazing my chin and my neck on both sides. At that point, I don't even remember the particulars, except I just started to scream, and the bullets were coming really quickly. I got hit in the face. I believe that was the fourth bullet, a bullet which actually shattered some of my teeth. And then the fifth bullet, there was something about the way that I was sitting which made me in Stephen Roy Carr's range and not Rebecca. So by the fifth bullet, Rebecca had told me to get down close to the ground, and I did. And the fifth bullet hit me at the top of my head. It kind of grazed the back of my head. So I guess she realized that he could hit me even that low, and she told me to run. So I immediately ran to a big tree on the campsite, and as soon as I moved, Stephen Roy Carr must have had access to Rebecca, you know, because I had moved. And, of course, she started to run, too, and he was able to hit her twice, once in the back of the head. That was the sixth bullet. And then in the real meaty part of her back, that was the seventh bullet. The eighth bullet missed us both, and we both wound up behind a tree.
You didn't even realize at first what was happening, you know, that you'd been shot. When you realized that somebody was shooting at you, did you figure it was the man who you'd seen with the rifle earlier?
I was certain that it was the man we had seen with the rifle, who, of course, had no name in my mind then, because he was the only person that Rebecca and I had seen the whole time we had been out, which was only just about a day, but he was the only person that we had seen on the trail at all, and he had had a gun.
Was your mind working when you were shot and you had to figure out, now what do I do?
At first, I would say that I was utterly and completely panicked. And when I was screaming, I was somewhat paralyzed. Rebecca told me what to do. She told me to get down first. Then she told me to run behind a tree. I'm fairly sure that I would have died if she hadn't been there, that she really saved my life somehow. Somehow her brain was still functioning in the emergency. When we got behind the tree, she continued to function. In fact, she was the one who told me to stop the bleeding. I was bleeding a lot externally. And she was bleeding, but I didn't know. Of course, she was bleeding internally. But in any case, at some point after I started to stop my own bleeding and I realized how badly Rebecca was actually hurt, my brain started to click in, and I really started to function well. But up to that point, I had been completely paralyzed with fear and was not thinking that clearly.
You knew that you needed to get help, but Rebecca couldn't walk. She was hurt too bad. But must have been a really difficult decision to leave her behind and to go look for help.
Probably that was, as scary as the whole shooting was, probably that was the worst moment for me, was the realization that we weren't both getting out of there and the realization that I had to leave her and get help by myself. That was it was already as awful as you could possibly imagine, and I knew it was just dreadfully, horribly awful, but when I had to go by myself and I had to leave Rebecca, it became even more awful.
It amazed me reading your memoir, Eight Bullets, that you remembered to take certain things with you. What did you take?
It was sort of incredible that once my brain started functioning, I really began to think, and I began to think as one would think in an emergency. So I remembered that I needed a map to get out of there because we had been hiking with a map. So I went to look for the map, and at first I couldn't find it. I ran back to Rebecca. Then I went back, and I found the map. Then I thought maybe I would need a flashlight because I knew it was toward the end of the day already, and I thought it would get dark, and what if it got dark and I needed a flashlight? So I went to our packs and I looked for a flashlight, and I finally found a flashlight. And then finally I realized I was cold. My shirt was soaked with blood, and I put on a sweatshirt, and that was the last thing that I did was I got a sweatshirt for me, and then I got a sleeping bag and covered up Rebecca, who I figured was probably cold also.
Now, what did you think the odds were that the guy who shot you was going to be hiding behind a tree ready to knock you off when you went looking for help?
I didn't know. I thought the entire walk that it was entirely possible that he would be there at any moment and that he would blow me away. And I guess I figured that would be better than just dying in the woods for me. I didn't think I was going to die. at that point. Something started to happen in my body as a result of either stopping the bleeding, and what I now know is I actually stabilized my body in some kind of shock place. But I was okay. I mean, I was okay to walk, and I was okay to move forward. I had a hard, very, very hard time swallowing, and I had a very hard time turning my neck, but I was able to walk.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Claudia Brenner, and she's written a memoir called 8 Bullets, about how she was shot 5 times and how her lover Rebecca was shot to death in 1988 on the Appalachian Trail. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Claudia Brenner, her memoir 8 Bullets is about how she was shot and how her lover Rebecca was shot to death in 1988 on the Appalachian Trail. When you knew you had to get out of the woods and look for help, you really, it seems to me you were really smart. I mean, you had your map, you found the trail that led to the road, you realized you should stay on the road, you even thought that the guy who shot you probably wouldn't be on the road because he'd probably be out hiding someplace if he had any brains. But it took hours before a car stopped for you.
It took hours, and I just walked. I remember I was thinking in my head just very few thoughts over and over again. One of the thoughts I was thinking about was just walk. Don't run. Don't try and run. Just walk. Just keep walking. And when I would get tired, I would just keep on walking. And I thought about what I would say when I finally saw somebody. What would I say to them? And I composed several sentences in my mind, which I actually said to the car that eventually stopped for me.
What were the sentences?
In my mind, I decided I would say, "You must help me. I've been shot." And that's exactly what I said, actually, when a car stopped.
How many cars passed you by?
Only one car passed me by, and I was just completely flabbergasted. I didn't know what to think. I thought I was waving it down, and they just kept on going.
So tell us about the people who stopped for you. So
finally, I got to an intersection of a large road. The car that passed me by actually passed me by on a state forest road. But I finally got to the intersection of what you might think of as a two-lane highway. And I stepped out into the road. It was dark by then, and I had my flashlight, and I was determined that no other car would pass me by. I made huge circles of light with my flashlight, and a car pulled up, and it had 2 young men in it, 17 and 16, local kids. It was an older, kind of big American car, and as soon as I saw that it wasn't the guy with the gun, I was entirely relieved, and then I said to them, "You must help me. I've been shot." And they put me in the car right away and took me in the direction of emergency help. It was still about a 20-minute ride till we got to a small town that had a fire and police station.
And you told them the facts that they needed to know in case you lost consciousness.
Yeah, I just told them over and over what my name was and that Rebecca White was on the trail and where she was, as much information as I could give them about where we had been and that she had been shot.
So the guys who picked you up, they took you to the police station, then you went to the hospital, and then you were actually helicoptered to a trauma center.
Right, I was... At each step of the process, it became clearer to me that, you know, I was really badly injured. And at some point, I had to relinquish the idea that I was going to go back and look for Rebecca, you know, show the police where Rebecca was. They immediately started a search for Rebecca in the first town where I was taken and, you know, had organized a search for her.
When did you find out that she was dead?
I actually didn't find out that Rebecca was dead until the next morning. The state police found her about midnight, and when I was in the trauma unit at Hershey Medical Center, I actually asked a nurse there not to tell me if she was dead. I said that I just didn't want to hear from strangers, and he relayed that information to the state police, and in fact, they withheld that information from me. And the next morning, my closest friends were with me, and one of them told me.
You were told that Rebecca would have died even if she was shot on an operating table because the wound, one of the shots in particular, hit her so badly there was no way she was going to live.
Yeah, I was told that, and her liver exploded. That's how she died. And that actually helped me because that walk took me a long time, and I think it would have been torture to think that had I gone more quickly somehow, had I gotten help more quickly, she might have lived. In some ways, the simpleness of that statement, which was told to me by medical people, made somehow that the timing of it all easier to bear.
Claudia Brenner is my guest. Her new memoir is called 8 Bullets. When when the police asked you what had happened, you didn't reveal to them that you and Rebecca were lovers. Why did you decide that you should keep that a secret?
That part of the my non-disclosure, I didn't disclose to the police that Rebecca and I were lovers for about 2 days. Although I of course told my friends and my family immediately that he saw us, which was a very powerful statement, which was understood immediately, that someone saw us, realized that we were lesbians, and shot us because we were lesbians. I think that my self-protection as a lesbian clicked in somewhere in that emergency, and I felt so unsafe and so traumatized that without making a conscious decision that first night, I withheld my relationship from the police. I just told them the facts. And of course, several days later, I told them everything, and that turned out to not even be a stumbling place in terms of the Pennsylvania State Police.
So what was the reaction of the investigators when you told them that you were gay?
The state police very quickly realized, I think, that Rebecca and I were lovers. So I don't think that that was any surprise to them. I think that they were relieved to hear everything from me that I could possibly share, because I think that then they knew that they had all the possible information that they could use to, capture the murderer and proceed with the case. And I think that by then, there had been quite a lot of questioning of myself, my chosen family, my friends who were present, my parents who were also present at the hospital. And I think that the state police had a certain amount of respect for the feat that I had undertaken getting myself out of the woods. They saw where we were. They saw the state of affairs there. And I think that they began to believe me. I think they had believed me from the beginning, but I think that when they had all the information, they completely believed me and had a lot of information to go on in terms of their investigation. Much later, a few days later, they were able to bring in an FBI artist, and I was able to create a composite, which was very helpful in the capture of Stephen Roy Carr.
Claudia Brenner is my guest. Her new memoir, 8 Bullets, is about how she was shot 5 times and her lover, Rebecca, was shot to death in 1988 on the Appalachian Trail. Did the defense try to use against you the fact that you were lesbians?
The defense tried very hard to use the issue of lesbianism to inflame the case. One of the things that the defense wanted to suggest was that somehow Rebecca and I making love together provoked their client into a rage of some sort where his actions became uncontrollable. And of course, provocation in the eyes of the court has nothing to do with the circumstances of Stephen Roy Carr's shooting. He was hidden 85 feet away in the woods. He had deliberately and intentionally stalked us and followed us and hid and spied on us. And then he opened fire, continuing to shoot us even after we were screaming. Nothing about strangers who have no connection and someone hiding and shooting has anything to do with provocation, but it was an effort on the part of the defense to inflame the case and cause attention to be focused on lesbianism as opposed to being focused on murder. I might say it was fully unsuccessful in the eyes of the court, and it was not permissible as a defense, but there was still that effort on the part of the defense.
What was the outcome of the case?
The outcome of the case was that Stephen Roy Carr was convicted of first-degree murder. He was sentenced to life with no parole in maximum security prison in Pennsylvania.
So do you feel safe from Stephen Roy Carr knowing that he's serving life without parole?
Yeah, I certainly don't feel threatened by Stephen Roy Carr in particular. No, I feel like he is within the system and that he's a person whose resources are very, very limited, and I don't anticipate that he'll have any success on any appeal that he might decide to proceed with, or any success with requesting clemency from the governor.
Having been the victim once now of anti-gay violence, are you worried in a way that you'd never been before about it happening again?
I really didn't know very much about anti-gay violence when Rebecca and I got shot. I think I thought, like many, many people think, that anti-gay violence was a matter of harassment. It was something that happened, I thought, you may think the same thing, that it happened late at night outside of bars to men, maybe in a bad part of town, certainly with some alcohol involved. And in fact, it does happen in those circumstances. But I had no idea that it could happen and be a matter of life and death. And I had no idea that it could happen, you know, in a rural situation, in an urban situation, to women, to men, to college graduates, to, you know, people that were, you might say, playing by the rules. So am I frightened of it particularly now? I'm probably more aware that it can happen now than I was before, but I don't think that I'm more frightened.
Now, I understand you and your friends won't go camping anymore.
Well, you know, some of the joy of being out in the woods, some of the joy and of that peace for me has been permanently taken, or as far as I can tell, it's been 7 years now, and it's not appealing to me to be out in the woods, and I'm sad about that, but I don't consider that a gigantic loss in my life. So, yeah, I'm not that comfortable. I no longer can just breathe deep and enjoy the solitude of the woods and the silence of the woods. It's something that I don't know that I'll have access to again.
Well, Claudia, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Claudia Brenner's new memoir, 8 Bullets, is published by Firebrand Books. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.